our study of the book of Acts as we're following along with material that Bob and Sandra Waldron wrote entitled Go Tell the Good News. And we're looking at the spread of the gospel, of course, in the first century, taking, as we go along, some helpful tips and information from the apostles and other evangelists as they spread the gospel in the world to maybe help us be able to spread the gospel more effectively. We're looking at Paul's second missionary journey, as we call it. This is not wanting to advance, guys. No, it, oh, there it goes. Never mind. looking at his second missionary journey. And we've been to a point where we've kind of paused for a couple of class periods. We followed Paul from Antioch all the way through Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, to Troas, of course, across the Aegean Sea, the events in Philippi with Lydia and the Philippian jailer. Then he goes to Thessalonica, where there's a violent persecution. He's taken from Thessalonica to Berea, and the persecution follows him from Thessalonica to Berea. And so the saints spirit him away to Athens, where he spends some time. Acts chapter 17, of course, the Sermon on Mars Hill. And then he goes from Athens to Corinth, and that's where Acts chapter 18 has us. And when he gets to Corinth, he finds, first of all, Aquila and Priscilla. This is all, by the way, a review. But he finds Aquila and Priscilla in Corinth, and he lodges with them. They're of the same trade. We talked about that. And he goes into the synagogue, and he reasons every Sabbath, persuading both Jews and Greeks, it says in Acts 18 and verse 4. And then Silas and Timothy, who he's had to leave behind and send back, actually, to Macedonia, they join him. And about that time, first of all, there's some opposition that occurs from the Jews because of Paul's testimony concerning the Christ. He's basically not allowed to be in the synagogue anymore, but he goes next door, entered the house of a certain man named Justus, and he continues to teach and to preach. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believes and becomes a Christian. He's baptized, and many of the other Corinthians were as well. And Paul sees a vision in which he's told not to be afraid because the Lord has many people in that city. And he continues there for 18 months preaching and teaching. We've taken the last two class periods to kind of step away then from this account in the book of Acts to notice that during this time frame right here, he writes a letter back, two letters back, to the Thessalonians. And we've spent some time looking at the context of all of that and the text of those two letters to see how it dovetails into what Paul is experiencing and has experienced during this part of his journey. And I think there's a lot of great information. I hope that you've been able to see that as we've looked at 1st and 2nd Thessalonians the last couple of weeks, or last couple of class periods, I should say. Well, so this morning we're going to go on and go back to the text here in Acts and finish out Paul's stay in Corinth and also finish out really his second journey. We'll try to get to all of that today. Then spend the last class period of the quarter on Wednesday night doing a review of the entire book of Acts thus far. So let's go on and look at Acts chapter 18, and we'll start reading in verse 12. When Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, "This fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." So their complaint that they brought before Gallio, who's the Roman proconsul, is that Paul's stirring things up by trying to get people to worship God according different from what our law says that they should worship. So Gallio basically doesn't have a very kind disposition toward the Jews on this occasion. He takes a pretty dim view of their complaint. And the text says, when Paul was about to open his mouth, and you can just see Paul, he's probably, although this is a dangerous situation, he may be facing some serious persecution here, he's thinking, but he's still chomping at the bit to tell somebody about Jesus. And that shows us the courage, and it takes a lot of courage to tell people about Christ in the face of opposition when emotions are running high. Certainly the Jews who brought him, who brought Paul before this proconsul, they were angry, they were upset, they were trying to cause Paul trouble. Paul doesn't know what Gallio might do, but he has a lot of courage, and he's about to speak to Gallio, and we can only imagine what he would have said, but it would have been a lot like what he said in other times when he was before councils and kings as he defends himself and the gospel of Christ. So he's ready to do that and is about to do that, but Gallio says to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be a reason why I should bear with you. But if it is a question of words and names and your own law, look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge in such matters. So Gallio basically refuses to hear their complaint. The Romans, by and large, at this point in history, had agreed to allow the Jews to practice their own religion throughout the Roman Empire. But it's one thing to agree for somebody to do something like that or for a group to do something like that. That's another thing for that group to always be causing problems over it. And the Romans at this stage in history were becoming, let's say, more than mildly irritated about the problems that the Jews were causing throughout the provinces concerning the practice of their own religion, the way that Romans saw it, problems that they were causing. So, you know, the Jews had been kicked out of Rome just not too much prior to this. That's why Aquila and Priscilla were in Corinth. And here you've got Jews now in Corinth. And Gallio is a Roman proconsul. He knows the Jews have been kicked out of Rome. He knows, you know, they're just getting kind of a reputation for being a bit of troublemakers and malcontents. And so that's kind of how he treats them here. Notice the words that he uses. If it were really a matter about the law, I might bear with you, he says. You know, you guys are sort of a burden to be born. But if it was something that was genuine, I'd bear with you. But because it's not really a genuine concern of Roman law, I really don't care to hear it, is what he says. And you sort of get this attitude of almost a disdain for the whole situation that Gallio has, not only in what's said to this point, but then in the next couple of verses. Verse 16 tells us that he drove them from the judgment seat. I don't know that means he personally drove them, but there were lictors and Roman soldiers around who would have seemed to basically pushing the Jewish crowd out of the judgment seat. The text says in verse 17, I'm going to read from the New King James Version. Some of the translations have this just a little bit differently, a little bit different. Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. But Gallio took no notice of these things. So you see Gallio's ambivalence. Even when there's violence going on around his judgment seat, he doesn't care. He doesn't want to get involved in this. This is not his problem as he sees it. And he's not going to, even when somebody's being beaten in his presence, he's not going to intervene or do anything on anybody's behalf on this occasion. Now, again, depending on what translation you're using, some translations don't have it that the Greeks are doing the beating here. Some translations just say they took Sosthenes and beat him, which could be that the Jews might have done the beating. But it's hard to understand why they would beat the ruler of their own synagogue unless they thought, you know, he was doing a terrible job or something like that. But it's hard to understand why they would be the ones doing the beating. This is one of those places, and I know you all love these places, where the Greek manuscripts have different readings, and that's the problem in the translations, the English translations that we have. The very earliest Greek manuscripts don't have the Greeks taking him and beating him here. That just says they did. But a good number of older manuscripts that are pretty reliable do have that the Greeks took him and beat him. So that's where the difference in translation comes in. That makes more sense to me that the Greeks, in other words, the people of Corinth, would take the ruler of the synagogue and they would just lay into him because, hey, you're causing problems in our city, you know, we're trying to get you out of here. The proconsul doesn't even want to hear your case. And so they start basically manhandling the ruler, the leader of the Jews, and beating him right in front of Gallio. And Gallio, he doesn't even care. You know, it's like he feels like maybe Sosthenes deserves to be beaten. You know, he didn't command it. He didn't rule against the Jews. But that's the kind of feeling I get from this, that Gallio is so ambivalent about all of this that that he even allows this to go on, the Greeks. This Sosthenes may or may not be, probably is not, an individual mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. He could, I guess, have been the ruler of the synagogue. After this beating, he decides, you know what, maybe I should look at Christianity and become a Christian later during Paul's stay, but we're not told that. So we don't know if he's the same guy that's mentioned in 1 Corinthians 1 or not. It's a bit of an interesting story, but it shows us the cultural situation, the problems, some of the problems that Paul is encountering as he tries to share the gospel. You know, we think we have problems. You know, we won't talk to somebody, a friend or a neighbor or somebody at work because we think they might not like us anymore. And yet everywhere Paul goes, we see real issues and real problems, violence breaking out, also, you know, him being brought before tribunals over and over and over again. And yet he's undeterred. And I think we can take a great lesson from that. You might notice a couple of other rather interesting things. The picture that you see here in the background is the Acrocorinth, which is the big rock that oversees the city of Corinth, where that temple to Aphrodite was that we talked about a couple of class periods ago. In the front, what you're looking at is Gallio's judgment seat. And I don't mean this is maybe kind of Gallio's judgment seat. This is where Gallio would have been situated. This is one of those sites that, if an archaeological site can be 100% certain, this is one of those sites where they're absolutely certain that this is where the judgment seat was. The Bema, or judgment seat, was situated in the Agora. The Agora, we talked about, is the big marketplace. Every Greco-Roman city had this big marketplace. And in Corinth, right in the middle of the Agora, was the judgment seat where the Roman proconsul would take cases, or not take cases in this case. And it's basically a platform on which the proconsul would stand or sit, as the case may be, to judge cases when making public appearances and so forth. Gallio would have sat right here, and so Paul would have stood right here somewhere. You realize these are ruins, but nonetheless, this is exactly where all that would have happened. It's a real place, and Gallio was a real person. The cool thing about Gallio is that we have an inscription with his name on it describing him as proconsul of Corinth during this time period. In fact, this inscription helps us to pinpoint the exact time that Paul was here. So as far as understanding the time flow and what year this was and all of that, this is one of the markers that we have. You have the Jews being kicked out of Rome. We know when that happened exactly. You have Gallio inscription that we're going to look at here, sometimes also called the Delphi inscription because it was discovered at Delphi. But right in the middle of this stone inscription, which I'll explain more about in a minute, you have Gallio's name. For those of you who love to read Greek, Gamma, Alpha, Lambda, Lambda, Yoda, Omega. In English, that's G-A-L-L-I-O, Gallio, right in the middle of that inscription. And what it says is basically that Gallio was indeed the proconsul here. Again, it's the inscription is written in Greek. It was a copy of a decree that was made by Emperor Claudius, who's the emperor of Caesar at this time. We've already talked about him. He's mentioned in the text. The plaque or the inscription is one that was found at Delphi, which is across the water a little ways from Corinth. But it talked about Claudius commanding Gallio to assist the resettlement of Delphi and revitalizing it. The inscription dates between April and July of AD 52. And it indicates that Gallio had been proconsul here for at least the past year. So, with all of that information, again, we know exactly when all of this happened. And I think that's very helpful to us. So, Paul's 18-month stay here in Corinth included the year 51 AD, and that this inscription is critical to helping us nail that down. It also, and the reason I'm really bringing it in as much as anything, is to show again, these were real people. These are real places. This isn't some sort of fictitious, you know, never-never land that somebody's made up and wrote these stories that never happened. The thing about Christianity is Christianity was born and grew and spread in the clear light of human history. And not only do we have the inspired biblical record of it, but we have many, many things outside of the inspired record which attest to the truthfulness of the story that the Bible tells. So I think that's helpful to us in our faith. All right. Y'all have some questions or other thoughts about any of that? No, that's not that exciting material to necessarily to talk about, but I think it's interesting. Let's go on and look then at Acts 18 and verse 18. Paul remained a good while still after these events. So the situation that occurred before Gallio didn't drive him out of Corinth. Now, that too is kind of interesting because you notice all of these other places, Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, when did Paul leave? What caused him to leave those places? Persecution, wasn't it? When persecution got hot, in fact, the brethren didn't want him to stay because it was unsafe for him. So they actually took him away a time or two, sent him away so that he would be safe. He wasn't running necessarily in fear, but it was just prudent. But in Corinth, after the Jews, you see, they try to start something. They try to start something, and it doesn't work. So Paul realizes that just as the Lord has said, the Lord has many people in this city, and the Lord is with him in this city. And so even after he's sort of brought before the judge, when Gallio acts as he does and doesn't harm Paul, Paul's kind of emboldened to stay here a while. And that's what he does, according to the text. So Paul remained still a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria. Priscilla and Aquila were with him. And, of course, Priscilla and Aquila, we know, to become Christians and vital helpers in Paul's work, especially at Ephesus later on. And they are kind of woven into the fabric of much of the rest of the life of Paul, as we see in later scripture. But the text says he had Priscilla and Aquila with him, and he had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he'd taken a vow. So then he came to Ephesus. Well, what you're looking at in the screen then is this is the port of Cenchrea. This is one of the two ports we talked about that served the city of Corinth, this major city of the first century. This is the port area where Paul would have disembarked. They sail for Syria from Cenchrea. Now, in saying Syria, again, you've got to have in your mind, what is that saying? Where is Paul ultimately wanting to go now? Syria, what big city is there that he took off from? Antioch, okay? So his intention now at this point, after this long journey, he's all the way in Corinth, and he says, okay, well, I need to head back to Antioch. After all of this time, all of these experiences, spreading the gospel this far, I need to head back to Antioch. He doesn't take the straight route. Now, Ephesus would have been a straight route, but we're going to see that he's going to go by Jerusalem first, we'll get to that in a second. But so that they sail for Syria from Cenchrea, and the text says, Paul had his hair cut off because he'd taken a vow. A couple of other things about Cenchrea. One is that there was a church there. Corinth is very close to Cenchrea. In fact, as I said, Cenchrea is the port city, the port of Corinth. But there was also a church in Cenchrea besides the church in Corinth. These were, sometimes I get asked, is it okay to have, churches established pretty close to one another? Well, I don't know that these two were as close as some of the churches in Athens are, but they were pretty close, less than a couple of miles from one to the other, probably, where they would be needed. So in Romans chapter 16, if you want to look over there, you have a passage where somebody else who was a helper of Paul is mentioned. Paul says, I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of what? The church in Cenchrea. Okay. That you may receive her in the Lord in the manner worthy of saints, a sister in whatever business she has need of you, for indeed she's been a helper of many and of myself also. So, no doubt, Paul received some help from Phoebe during this period of time, got to know her, probably converted her, but there's a church planted in Cenchrea as well as Corinth. Paul is simply sailing from Cenchrea at this point, but that's an interesting thing to understand about the geography of these places. The second thing is about Paul's vow. As far as we can tell, Paul had taken a vow probably in some connection to the Old Testament law. Now, Paul would be the first one to say that he was not bound to the Old Testament law. Right? In fact, he's defended that point in Acts chapter 15 before the council in Jerusalem. And yet, if you were a Jew and you were a Christian, were you still allowed to keep the feast and so on and so forth? Well, the answer to that is yes. And if you wanted to, live your life basically by the things that were in the law of Moses and subject yourself to the keeping of vows and so on and so forth, that's fine if you were a Jewish Christian. You're not to bind that on Gentiles. If you still wanted to circumcise your children, that's fine if you're a Jewish Christian. You just don't want to bind that on Gentiles. So it was perfectly fine for Jews to continue in those kinds of things as long as they realized their salvation wasn't going to come from that. And so they could still participate somewhat in Jewish culture, and that would give them access to talking to fellow Jews about the gospel, lots of things like that. In 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 20, when Paul talks about his approach to spreading the gospel, among the things that he says to the Jews, I became as a Jew. Remember that? So on more than one occasion, well, many occasions, he does a lot of things. He goes into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. That's a Jew thing to do, right? That's not a Gentile thing to do. He's going to keep a feast. He's got a vow here. Later on, he's going to go through some purification at the end of his third journey when he gets back to Jerusalem, a ritual purification in the temple with some other Jews, Jewish Christians. So There were Jewish things, if you will, that Paul would do. And a lot of it was, I think, motivated by what he says when he writes back to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 9:20. He says, to the Jews, I became as a Jew. If there were Jewish people who were celebrating some traditional feast or whatever it might be, I'd be right in there with them. If they're meeting in the synagogue on the Sabbath, I'd be right in there with them so that I might win them to Christ. That's his motivation. That's why he does these things. It's not to keep the law itself, but it's so that he might win them to Christ. We're not sure, and if you read the Waldron material on this, I think certainly Brother Waldron does a good job of at least briefly touching on this and explaining it. We're not sure exactly what kind of a vow Paul might have taken. Some people want to relate it maybe to a Nazarite vow of the Old Testament, and it seems some of that to fit and some of it not to fit. But there were vows that you might take that you cut your hair, and the hair that you cut was to be burned on the altar in the temple. And so one of the reasons Paul might have been so anxious to go to Jerusalem before he headed back to Antioch was to finish out this vow. Don't know that that's not said exactly, but that makes sense as far as what we know about how they took care of these vows. So all of that fitted together, and I'm just trying to explain the story, explain what's going on here so we understand it a little better. Here's a map of the area. This is the Peloponnesus. Here's Corinth. Here are the two port cities, Cenchrea and Lycaon. And we talked about this before, but Paul now is setting sail from Cenchrea. He'll come out of the Saronic Gulf and across the Aegean Sea. Here's Athens. So the voyage from Cenchrea to Ephesus is about 250 miles. Just think about getting in a boat that doesn't have a motor, and you got to go 250 miles. Now, of course, Paul would sail at times distances much greater than this. He's going to sail from Ephesus all the way down to Caesarea after this. So that's hundreds and hundreds of miles. He mentions, when he writes back to the Corinthians, the number of times that he'd been in a shipwreck. You know, sailing was no safe. Can you imagine, I've flown to, however many times I've flown to Africa or wherever, you know, and I said, yeah, I've flown this many times to these different places, you know, to preach the gospel. And by the way, I was the plane wrecked 3 times. You'd say, wow. But the shipwreck, three times he's been in shipwrecks. And so it's very dangerous. Again, you see what he's willing to do to spread the gospel. You see his dedication to what's going on in spreading of the gospel. But he goes this distance across the Aegean Sea and winds up in Ephesus, his journey of about 250 miles. So that brings us then to Acts chapter 18 and verse 19 or so. He came to Ephesus and left them there. The them is Aquila and Priscilla that we mentioned in verse 18. He himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. First thing he does, he's not even planning to stay, but the first thing he does, and while he's there, you know, why not go in and preach Christ in the synagogues? So he goes in, preaches Christ in the synagogue of the Jews, reasoning with them. What's their response? How do they react to Paul's preaching? Yeah, they extend an invitation. They want him to stay. They want to hear more. And you just feel like Paul was itching to stay and to share the gospel with them further. But he says, basically, I can't. I've got to get to Jerusalem for this feast, but I'll come back, is basically what he says. So he intends to do that. He may even want to stay now, but he doesn't do that. It says he left Aquila and Priscilla in Ephesus. He entered the synagogue, reasoned with the Jews. They asked him to stay a longer time with him. He did not consent, but took leave of them, saying, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem, but I will return again to you, God willing. And he sailed from Ephesus. What do you notice about the end of that verse? I will return to you, what does he say? God willing. Right? Did Paul ever have plans to evangelize that didn't work out like he thought they would? Yes. Yes, he did. Multiple times. He's planning, hoping to do this, go there, evangelize this area, and something, Satan will prohibit him, or hinder him, I should say. Other things will occur. Plans get changed. And yet, he doesn't let that discourage him. But he does have plans. And he says, God willing, I'll do this. What does that teach us about evangelism? Number one, let me just suggest some things. Should we make plans to evangelize? Okay, there you go. Let's make some plans. Let's say, I'm going to go to this neighbor. I'm going to go to that neighbor. I'm going to talk to this person at work. Now, you may go to this neighbor or that neighbor or this person. You may go to this neighbor and they may slam the door in your face. Well, your plans get changed pretty quick then, right? But that doesn't mean you stop. You know, just because something changes your plans, you may get sick. You may be transferred somewhere and you don't get to talk to that guy at work or whatever. He may be transferred away. Whatever. Plans might change, but that doesn't mean you don't make plans. And that doesn't mean you get discouraged when the plans have to be changed. And we think about the very simple things that we might plan to do, like talking to a neighbor or a coworker. Paul's planning to go, you know, all over the then known world to preach the gospel. And when his plans get changed, it's a big deal. But still, he doesn't let that dissuade him or discourage him. And I think there's a good lesson in that for us. So he sails from Ephesus now. He promises to come back, and he will come back and do probably his greatest localized work in Ephesus, which you'll cover next quarter. Through his work in Ephesus, eventually, the Bible will tell us that all of Asia will be evangelized because of the work that Paul does in Ephesus. But that's just sort of a dream for him at this point, just something that he had hoped for and was planning on, but he didn't know for sure. So here's the trip by sea to Caesarea. You see the distance there that Paul covered on this journey, and this wasn't even his longest trip by any means. This is the docks and the shoreline at Caesarea. I was able to take these pictures back in November. What you see on the left, that's literally the where the docks were, where ships would pull up to unload the cargo or unload the passengers. The water doesn't quite come up to them anymore, but it did in Paul's day. This would be part of the man-made harbor. You might remember a studying that Herod made. It's part of that man-made harbor. And this, again, this isn't maybe the place. This is the exact place that Paul would have stepped off the boat to finish his voyage from Ephesus to Caesarea. You see the picture of the Mediterranean there on the right. That building in the background there is a Crusader era building. It wasn't there during Paul's day, but still you get a good idea of the shoreline and the sea as Paul would have seen it. So the text tells us that he arrives at Caesarea. He'd intended, you remember what he says in verse 21, he takes leave of the people at Ephesus. He says, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem. So his intention is first to go to Jerusalem and keep a feast. Again, we as a Jew, he had a perfect right to do that. He may, again, have something to do with his vow as well, and the hair that he cut off, not sure about that, but we know his intention is to keep a feast. He says to the Ephesians, I will return to you. So he lands in Caesarea, that's in verse 22, and it says, the King James Version says, he'd gone up and greeted the church. Well, which church is that? Probably Jerusalem. Okay. The idea of going up to, again, this is the King James version of this, but the idea of going up to, which is the way that Jerusalem is always referred to, and then the text says he goes up to greet the church, gone up and greeted the church, and he went down to Antioch. Well, from a number of perspectives, you might say, well, Antioch, which is here, might be regarded as being up and Jerusalem as being down, but Jerusalem is always up to the Jew, right? Jerusalem is always up. It's a place you go up to because of the spiritual significance of the temple being there and it being God's city. Yes, sir. Yes, it was high place. It is you can't get to it without going up because there's valleys all around it. So, you know, it's one of those places you've got to go up to get there, from a physical standpoint as well. And that's a good point. Well, he goes back and then he goes down to Antioch, it says in verse 22. And we're not told anything about his stay in Antioch. It just says that he went there, which is what he intended to do when he left Corinth. We saw he was intending to go to Syria. Antioch is in Syria. At Antioch is the church that had sent Paul on this journey. Remember that? Sent Paul on his first journey, second journey, and he'll leave from there on his third journey. So Paul feels special affinity for this church. After his first journey, what did he do? What did he and Barnabas do when they got back to Antioch? They gave a report of all that they'd done. Why would Paul want to go to Antioch on this occasion? We're not told one thing other than that he stayed there a while. But that's a fair assumption that he would do the same kind of thing that he did after his first journey. Let them know how the work had gone, report about that, sort of gather strength to go on the next journey. But he felt it important to take this extra, step to go visit the church in Antioch that had sent him out on to do this work. I think there's some lessons for us today there about what evangelists need to do as far as reporting about their work to those who've sent them out to do it, to those who are supporting them in it. It's important to communicate with people that are fellowshipping you in the work that you're doing. If you're an evangelist, if you've given yourself especially full-time to evangelism, you've been sent out or you're being supported by a church to do a given work. Now, you don't see it, but in verse 23, you have the start of the third missionary journey. You don't have that. Probably you don't even have a heading in your Bible that men have put there or something that says start of third journey. But very subtly, we end the second journey and he starts the third journey. Now, the news is my assignment for this quarter was to cover just to get through the second journey, so we're done. So I stop at the beginning of verse 23. That's where I stop. And what we'll do Wednesday night, Lord willing, is I'll try to give a review of the entire book of Acts, in Acts chapter 1, up until Acts 18 and verse 23. We will not go through, I'm not Wayne Holt, I can't give you every last detail of all of this in one lesson, so I won't even try to do that, but I would like to try to cover the big ideas and the flow of the spread of the gospel, just to try to, one of the things, and I'll say this again Wednesday night, Lord willing, one of the things I noticed about our study of God's Word is we study it like we have detail, and I went through a whole bunch of details even today, probably a lot more than you wanted to hear, about some of these things, but you get all of these details, and then because you're looking at the details all the time, sometimes you don't really get an idea about the big picture, and you lose the big picture. To me, the big picture is every bit as important as the details. So to understand sort of the big picture of the book of Acts from chapter 1 through chapter 18, I think that's really important. Or you could sit down and have a conversation with somebody and tell them, well, here's what happens in the book of Acts, and without having to take 3 days to do it. You know what's in the book of Acts. You have this idea of how it all progresses. And you could share that with somebody, or you have it as background information as you study other books. So that's what we'll try to do Wednesday night, is just sort of get some big picture ideas about this section of Scripture. Anybody have anything to ask or add at this point? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Mike is mentioning that, especially with Aquila and Priscilla, sort of peek ahead to what's going to happen with them and how God's going to use them. He's going to use them in Ephesus. Paul met them in Corinth. They wind up in Ephesus. They do important work in Ephesus by bringing Apollos. We'll talk about that in Acts 19. And then they wind up back in Rome eventually, where they've been kicked out of when Paul met them in Corinth. So, and Paul will mention them in Romans 16. they're going to be an integral part of the story, and we've been introduced to them. We're leaving them in Ephesus now, but they'll be really an important part of the spread of the gospel. All right, let's stop there, and we'll pick up there and do our review on Wednesday.